Oh, hi there. My name's Adriana Pereiro. Nice to meet you. Here with the very first episode of Infectious, a podcast where we will explore a new infectious disease every 2 weeks. A little about myself, because we have to always have a formal introduction. I'm an epidemiologist. I've worked in surveillance for a few different disease types, including enteric infections, think salmonella and E. coli, HIV, and now COVID-19. But I've always loved to learn about biology, a self-proclaimed nerd for my entire life, and I've really found my niche in infectious diseases and love to speak about them with other individuals. So welcome to my little brainchild, where I hope to learn with you whenever we can about some of the most intriguing components of our world. On that note, let's get ready this week for the very first episode, where we'll take a journey down under to a little island just north of Australia to talk about a disease wrapped up in beautiful rainforests, a little bit of sorcery, and just a pinch of cannibalism. Because why not? This week, we'll be dipping into one of the most novel diseases discovered in the 21st century, Kuru, also known as Laughing Death, an infectious spongiform encephalopathy, a phrase I promise you will understand by the end of this, that makes those afflicted burst into laughter, lose complete control over their bodies, and happen to actually win a Nobel Prize or two. So, let's get going.
A second health nightmare has emerged in Melbourne with 36 people struck down with salmonella poisoning.
Measles now a public health emergency with a surge of those infected.
This week saw the galloping rise of SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome.
Yellow fever spreads quickly here in the Lowndah slums. The fever is transmitted by mosquitoes.
Amazing. So let's get into this. First, I'll provide a quick summary from an eyewitness account of the illness, move into some history and the hypothesized emergence of the disease, transition to speak about the clinical symptoms of the infection, describe how the novel agent that causes the disease was finally discovered, and finally talk about the agent itself and how it transforms a brain to cause the symptoms that were observed among Kuru patients. Thankfully, Kuru was a pretty rare disease at its peak, only found within the eastern central highlands of Papua New Guinea during the 20th century. Although rare, it was greatly feared among the local peoples, known for how quickly and decisively it bared death to those who it grasped, transitioning from early flu-like symptoms to death within just a few months. A course of disease with such gruesome and rapid progression that the locals could only attribute it to the work of sorcery. Quote, Kuru started with a headache, and then it came and affected the eyes. The eyes would start seeing two things. Then he started missing the vowels and words, and then everyone would notice that he had Kuru, and then the whole family would start worrying. It would affect his walking, and he wouldn't walk straight. He would fall, and later on, he would start using sticks to walk, and after that, he would leave the stick and sleep. As he slept, it was difficult for him to turn. His thighs and buttocks would decay and die, and whatever part of the body he lay on, worms would come out, and he would have to pull out the worms while he was still alive. He would go to the toilet in his own bed, and friends and family would clean it for him. There were times when the wounds were real bad, when the parents and relatives would get tired because the wounds stunk so bad, and it was then that I had to clean it, clean those who were rejected by their families, and take care of them. It was then that they died. That quote shares the insight of Turubi, and is taken from The Promised Medicine, a very, very well-written article by Ian Beasley on the topic of Kuru and getting some insight from the local people. At the time, Turubi was a young man who worked to care for Kuru patients if their families could no longer sustain the efforts. And his quote, or his insights, really provide a detailed picture of how real and scary the threat of Kuru was for the people of Papua New Guinea. So you may ask, where exactly is Papua New Guinea? Where are we talking about? And for those less enchanted by the complex geography of the Southern Pacific, which included me just a few weeks ago, Papua New Guinea is the right half of the island called Guinea, just to the north of Australia, and it encompasses a landmass that is approximately the size of Spain or California, so it's pretty big. But compared to the size of North America or all of Europe, it was pretty small, which makes it very, very amazing how ecologically and culturally diverse the setting was. First of all, it has the third biggest rainforest in the world, only challenged by the mighty Amazon and Congo, and the Pacific's largest area of mangrove forests, coral reefs, and seagrass beds. Also, though, this remarkable diversity was not only found within nature, but extended to the indigenous cultures as well. Despite being home to only 7 million people, the population of Papua New Guinea belonged to over 700 different cultural groups, each with their own unique languages and distinct forms of cultural expression. I had to look into this because, as someone who used to study a lot of biology, I was really interested to the ecological forces that was driving this huge amount of diversity. And not surprisingly, it seems as though Papua New Guinea's terrain, because it's so difficult to move through, creates these very natural segregations in the land. And because it then becomes difficult for different animals as well as different peoples to interact, it creates an environment where a kaleidoscope of different cultures and different ecological niches can arise. And that allows for the diversity to not only develop, but also thrive and sustain over time. Therefore, it's not shocking that these same factors that limited the intermixing of different cultural groups would also affect disease transmission. More specifically, in respect to Kuru, this highly segregated nature of each peoples helped early investigators better understand how the disease was spread. So, although this disease was well known amongst the indigenous people of Papua New Guinea in the area that was affected by Kuru, Kuru, or the Laughing Death, was first identified and described by Europeans only in 1936, which was approximately about 40 years after it first arose. It was first witnessed by a gold prospector named Ted Ubank, but little investigation was truly done until the Four region came under the Australian administration in 1947. By the early 1950s, police and patrol posts had begun to be established, and regular patrols were conducted in an attempt to establish law and order among the Four, who lived in a region that was known as the Eastern Central Highlands of Papua New Guinea. It's at this point that detailed descriptions of Kuru began to arise in the public record, with stories of the disastrous and fatal condition quickly spreading to the mainland, interesting early investigators to explore the disease further. This led to multiple medical health officers being assigned to the region to explore and support the Four people by the Australian administration. Eventually, this led to the creation of brilliantly detailed collections of work focused to investigate the mysterious disease's clinical progression as well as its geographical expanse. This was largely led by an American and Estonian physician named Dr. Daniel Gajetisek and Vincent Zikas, and later was complemented by additional work by the Australian physician Michael Albers. So, upon the arrival of these medical officers of health, they quickly began to collect very detailed information to understand the geography and the origins of the disease, as it was believed that understanding these would allow them to help to prevent it in the future. So, the first step, as everyone should, was they talked to the locals, and the locals shared super detailed information on the disease's origin, with the very strong belief that it actually had arose very, very recently. This was shocking. This wasn't something that had been ancient, had been around for so long, similar to leprosy or yaws. It was quite new. So it appeared from listening to these stories that the disease first arose in the Uwami village of the Kigana people, but it quickly spread, and only 50 years later, it had become endemic in 172 villages across the Central East Highlands, affecting a population of over 40,000 individuals in an area that would be known later as the Kuru region. This area was only 2,600 square kilometers in size and was bordered in the south by the Lomari River and to the north by the mountainous terrain. Among the linguistic groups that were affected, the Four were the most severely hit, experiencing over 80% of recorded Kuru cases, while the other 20% of cases were found among neighboring groups that had close cultural and marital ties to the Four people. This included the Aiwani, the Awa, the Osurufo, the Kanite, Kigana, Iati, Kamano, and finally the Gimi. Interestingly, though, and something that was strongly noted by these early investigators, among groups that did not intermarry with the Four, such as the Kukukuku to the south of the river and the remote Iagaria people, no Kuru cases were ever found. These findings gave birth to two main hypotheses of how the disease was spread. The first was that Kuru was caused by a genetic mutation that was spread through intermarrying and giving birth. The second was that it was actually caused by a very slow infectious agent transmitted through some social contact or shared ceremony, which would explain why it was only found between groups that interacted with one another. But I'll touch on these at a bit of a later point. On that note, now that we have an idea of where Kuru arose from and its geographic bounds, let you and me touch on the symptoms of the disease. So, unfortunately, for the scientific understanding of Kuru, the very first Kuru patients that were brought to the mainland, i.e. Australia, for treatment were women, which means that they got the best treatment ever. Wink, wink, nod, nod. But actually, what happened when they were first observed by these Australian physicians was that they were quickly written off as having hysteria. And for those who don't know about medical history, hysteria was an extremely common diagnosis for women, which was used to basically describe a plethora of symptoms when a physician could not be bothered or could not figure out what was actually affecting them. These symptoms included
anxiety, shortness of breath, fainting, nervousness, sexual desire, loss of sexual desire, insomnia, fluid retention, heaviness of the abdomen, irritability, loss of appetite for food, and even just a tendency to cause trouble for others.
So, as a note here, hysteria and the inability to understand that women could also be sick in addition to men and that they had different symptoms compared to what is observed in our male counterparts was actually, and is still, a very huge issue in the study of clinical disease in total and is a topic I'd love to touch on later, but I'll just like push that aside for this moment. Anyways, back to Kuru. When proper investigations began, it was quickly observed that this was truly a progressive neurodegenerative disorder with a shocking uniformity among its victims. In all, there were four distinct stages of the illness. This included the prodrome, the ambulant stage, the sedentary stage, and finally, the terminal stage of the disease. Shockingly, people would progress from the prodromal stage to the end of their life within about 12 to 14 months, which was shocking to say the least and extremely scary for those who were affected by it. So let's go through this disease course. The first stage of the illness, commonly referred to as a prodrome, largely resembled that of an acute respiratory infection, but minus the cough. So think weakness, having a headache, experiencing limb pain, often in the joints, knees and ankles coming first, followed by elbows and wrists, weight loss, and the experience of some stomach pain. Really though, it was everything that comes with the common cold, although the most important part, the coughs, the sneezes, they were absent. Locals would often say that patients would await cough, and when cough did not come, they awaited Kuru. This stage was largely only known to the individual who was experiencing it, and therefore allowed for the onset of the illness to largely be kept secret from others at the very beginning of the disease. Of note though, one reason that this is called a prodrome rather than the first stage of the disease and why this might be like a little bit controversial is because at the point that you experience the prodrome, those symptoms could be really seen because of many diseases. So they're not sufficient in order to diagnose the disease, but they are sufficient retrospectively to say it had begun. And that's kind of where the entire term of prodrome comes from. Anyways, now that we've progressed from the prodrome, we entered the ambulant stage, where the patient would begin to experience just a slight self-perceived unsteadiness in stance and gait, and a bit of a shakiness of the voice, hands, and eyes. These were often only felt by the patient and were so slight that others could not detect them around them. This included slight instability, as I said before, a loss of proprioception, or the ability to kind of feel your surroundings, a crossing of the eyes, and just the slightest tremor of the limbs and body tremors while walking. Interestingly, though, this initial shivering really just resembled someone who was experiencing a hypersensitivity to the cold. They were just light shivers, but really, they seemed as though they had no apparent cause or reason. They were exacerbated by even the slightest cool breeze, but they could also be observed on blistering hot summer days, so definitely probably not caused by temperature itself. These individuals would also experience ataxia of all body symptoms. So ataxia normally refers to a lack of muscle control or coordination of voluntary movement, which would kind of create that appearance of drunkenness. So, you know, it would include speech, stumbling, falling, and incoordination. And this loss of coordination would begin at the lower extremities and begin to move up the patient's body, and would often first show itself as the patient stamping their feet or having their toes claw and grip at the ground. Over time, though, it would slowly progress up the body until the entire form would be encompassed by wild and grotesque shaking movements. But that's a later stage of the illness. The next stage of the illness was the sedentary stage, where the patient could no longer walk without complete support. This stage kind of began as the ataxia and the tremors got worse, and they started to incapacitate the individual. They would reach a point where they could no longer walk without the support of some type of a cane or another individual helping them. And they also began to experience a stiffness of the limbs, accompanied by these horrible muscular spasms that would sometimes be shock-like, muscle jerks, and occasionally irregular and involuntary movements. This would often result in the patient being thrown into kind of like a exaggerated startled response and having extremely bad stability, often falling over. Interestingly, though, the deep tendon reflexes, deep tendon reflexes come as an effect of a signal going basically from the area of your body to your spinal cord and back, which means that it doesn't actually ever have to go to your brain to have that response. The most common one is where you have your knee hit with a mallet by the doctor and the other one kicks out. Interestingly, these were actually well maintained in this second stage of the disease. And although muscle activity was poorly maintained, there was no atrophy or loss of muscle mass over time. Interestingly, the sedentary stage would start to give birth to some mental symptoms of the illness. This included one of the most haunting symptoms, which was the uncontrollable loss of emotions found by some of the victims that would result in them having these pathological outbursts of laughter that they had no ability to control. Just imagine someone not being able to control their body, having these random shivering, and then just randomly bursting into uncontrollable laughing fits, giant smiles plastered across their face. This was one of the reasons that the disease was often referred to as the laughing death, as these individuals knew they were dying, but somehow couldn't even control themselves from laughing and seem as though they were in an amazingly large amount of joy. Of note, though, this was primarily a symptom in women. In the few males who had the illness, and I'll touch on this gender discrepancy later on, but in the few males who had this illness, they would sometimes be afflicted with a very deep depression, and sometimes show as a pathological belligerence to disturb their family, but that was pretty rare. In addition to these emotional effects and changes, patients would also begin to show mental slowing, although severe dementia was absent. Finally, as time passed, the patients would enter the terminal stage of the infection, where they could no longer sit or stand up without the support of others. They would lose their balance and fall down. It becomes too hard to walk, and eventually they can't even move. That's a quote from Etienne Nemu Bavasu from Kuru, The Science and the Sorcery, an amazing documentary that I suggest for anyone more interested in this topic to watch. So, as more time passed, the individual would experience more aggravated ataxia and tremors, and would progressively become more and more severely incapacitated until they could no longer move, and even to the extent that they could no longer control their bowels and their bladder, and then they would become dependent on their family members to clean their bodies, or else they would just have to sit in their defecation. As well, this loss of coordination that happened everywhere else in their body would finally reach their head, and they would no longer be able to swallow food or drink without the help of others as well. And basically, they would become mute and unresponsive. Death from Kuru was often slow and painful. The terminally ill patient would lie in their hut, surrounded by attentive relatives unable to move, communicate, or control themselves. Often family members had to gently pry open their jaw to force food or fluids inside of them, and nevertheless be able to see their eyes, clearly recognizing the people around them, and even maybe attempting to smile. The patient would often finally succumb, usually emaciated, but occasionally quickly enough to be well-nourished, surrounded by their family members, their parents, often being cuddled, even though they were terminal, uncommunicative, incontinent, and foul-smelling. A truly, truly horrible description of a disease. And even scarier, a disease that all of these things would happen from onset to end in a few months. So at this point, I'm going to circle back and talk a little bit more about the epidemiology of this disease, because I think that who it affected really defined why it was so scary to this population. So, mortality rate. This was a deadly infection. 100% of people who showed those initial symptoms ended up also dying. At the time of its peak, the mortality rate was extremely high amongst the poor people, with over 200 people dying of the disease each year, a shockingly high number knowing the population in the Kuru-affected region was only 40,000 individuals. The other thing that made this high fatality rate so shocking was that it was mainly concentrated amongst the women and the children of the poor people. And not only that, but it was often concentrated in a single kinship group, and would just completely decimate the family. This sex imbalance in the prevalence resulted in many villages having a disproportionate number of males to female, which made the traditional way of life strained and forced many men to take on the roles of women as their numbers dwindled. As more and more individuals and kinship groups were affected by Kuru, and there appeared to be no cause, the poor people began to develop belief systems to try and explain it. And this resulted in there being a belief that Kuru was actually the result of some deep evil sorcery. In the four belief system, sorcery was believed to be the source of power and wealth, and a tool available to help individuals defend their kin or destroy their enemies. So in this case, the Kuru sorcery was believed to be a summoned ghost, created using a spell that would cause the victim to shake uncontrollably. While anthropological records carry various tellings of the spells that are necessary to cast Kuru on your foes, one collection suggests that to cause Kuru, a would-be sorcerer would need to obtain a part of the victim's body, nail clippings, hair, or their excretions, with feces, urine, saliva, and blood being particularly potent ingredients. The person would then pack these pieces of the person into leaves and create something known as a Kuru bundle and place that into a swampy land. The sorcerer would then have to return daily to shake the package until the tremors of Kuru were induced in the victim. The thought and knowledge that this Kuru sorcery could be done by anyone created a lot of fear surrounding the apparent ingredients of the spell, and this resulted in many locals becoming extremely suspicious of outsiders and hyper-protective of small pieces of food that may contain saliva or also the clippings of their hair or even their feces. So there was this huge effort and energy put into burying and disposing these pieces of themselves in hopes of preventing the conjuring of the spell against themselves or their family. On this note, the people of Papua New Guinea viewed the sorcery as something that was bad. It was a type of murder, and often they sought justice through revenge killings. And this resulted in the second most likely way that the four people would die being revenge killings. This was because the killing of a man's wife and children was an incomprehensible evil, and therefore suspected sorcerers had to be swiftly sought out and killed in hopes of preventing the spell from taking the lives of an individual's kin or additional family members. You may ask, how were these sorcerers detected? And the answer is divination rituals. So one method that was often used in order to identify where the sorcerer was that a collection of water would be taken from a whole bunch of different sources, and then it would be given to the Kuru victim. If any of these waters induced vomiting, it would be considered to be near the sorcerer's residence, and then that would be an indication of how to identify the sorcerer. Another one was that they would place hair clippings from a Kuru victim into a bamboo cylinder and a freshly killed possum in another cylinder. They would then call the name of suspected sorcerers while shaking the cylinders, and a member of the victim's family would place the possum-contained cylinder in the fire. The sorcerer was identified if the liver of the possum believed to be the residence of his soul remained uncooked. Once the sorcerer had been identified, often from another kin group or even from another village, a ritualistic form of vendetta was conducted. This included crushing the bones of the neck, arm, and thighs with stones, as well as the loins, biting the trachea, and grinding the genitalia with stones and clubs. As suspected sorcerers were mostly adult men, whereas Kuru victims were mostly women and children of both sexes, killing of male sorcerers actually somehow contributed to there being more of a balanced sex ratio in the population. So even though Kuru was kind of devastating to women, these revenge killings were very, very devastating to men, and somehow it kind of helped balance it all out. One of the most unfortunate parts, though, is that in the Fora culture, it was not acceptable for someone who was not the mother to breastfeed a child or to actually care for a child that wasn't their own. Orphans were not allowed. And therefore, when many of these mothers died of Kuru, their children were left to die, malnourished. This is another reason why Kuru was so devastating, as men who were unable to care for their children once their wives were lost would see their entire family die, not only from Kuru, but also just from not being able to receive the care they needed. So I just want to say, upon Westerners' arrival, it was kind of quickly identified that it wasn't sorcery. Like, unfortunately, it was not sorcery. This is like a real infectious disease. And they were ready. Gadjetisic and Zikas arrived, and they were ready to figure out what this disease really was. And based on the data that was collected, they had some hypotheses. So the first one, which actually given just having the view that super high prevalence in women and children of kinship groups was pretty good. And the idea was that it was an autosomal gene, dominant in females but recessive in males. And then somehow in children, it was also dominant. And then kind of as you entered adulthood, it went away. So this hypothesis, though, was quickly set aside pretty early, as they kind of identified that the way that the four people defined kinship and the way that we in Europe and North America define kinship were quite different. The four had kinship as a view of ties between people, and they were often bred autosomally, making sense. But then once you actually removed and said that this person couldn't have gotten it from their mother, it made absolutely no sense. So anyways, we figured out Kuru could not be an autosomally transmitted genetic mutation. So that really left only one possibility to explain the spread for many scientists. The condition had to be a slowly spreading infectious agent, right? It couldn't be like measles. It couldn't be rapidly spreading, or else the likelihood that it would be in everyone in the population made more sense. But the other thing was, in early investigations in laboratory animals, we couldn't infect anyone with Kuru. There was no vi that resulted in Kuru being spread. And here's where the real magic of this entire story comes together, because they'd been trying to figure this out early 1950s, right? No clue. How's this spread? It can't be a virus. It can't be a bacteria. We have no way that this is spread. And Gadjetisic, who was one of the leading physicians in this entire story, received a letter from William Hadlow, a veterinary neuropathologist who'd seen the pictures of Carew's neuropathology taken by Polish-born neuropathologist Klatzo at this medical museum in London, and he was like, I know what this is! So he gets on his little typewriter, or like maybe he did it with, I don't know, 1950 typewriter? Yeah, that seems right. So he gets on his typewriter and he's like, click, 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 to the Lancet, which, if you don't know, is the top medical journal even to this day, even though, like, I can't figure out where he's from, so I'm just gonna go with he's British. I've been impressed with the overall resemblance of Carew and an obscure degenerative disorder of sheep called Scrapie. The lesions in the goat seem to be remarkably like those described by Carew. All this suggests to me that an experimental approach similar to that adopted for Scrapie might prove to be extremely fruitful in the case of Carew, because I've been greatly impressed by the intriguing implication. I've submitted a letter to the Lancet. And Gajazik found the Hadlow suggestion very compelling when he found it. So we need to know what is Scrapie's, because not a human disease, but important. So Scrapie's is actually a fatal neurodegenerative disease that affects the nervous system of sheep and goats, and it's actually spread through the consumption of placental or allantoic fluids. So the placenta and the allantois are components of the sac that surrounds mammals while they grow inside the uterus. And what's interesting about Scrapie's was the symptoms included the slow loss of coordination, similar, which actually was the namesake of the disease, as the lambs would scrape their bodies against rough surfaces, which would result in them losing a lot of their wool, which was obviously undesirable. As well, they would smack their lips, have altered gaits, and collapse in convulsions. And when you think about this, the parallels between the two diseases is pretty unfathomable, and finally presented some indication of how Carew was likely spread. So, something that you will note here is transmission of Scrapie's was largely resulting from the consumption of body parts from another animal, right? They came from consuming the placenta of a goat, and then it went into a goat. And this turned Gajetasik into the right direction finally. As you see, the four had a very unique funerary practice. And what was that? They consumed their dead. Yes, ritualistic endocannibalism, the eating of one's relative as part of the mourning ritual, also known as transumption, which was put forward by Michael Alpers in a hope to kind of decrease the negative sentiments that are associated with cannibalism. But this practice was also not only in the Carew areas, but in many of the surrounding Eastern Highland groups, which Carew never developed. Which is why, right, the cannibalism was amongst the people of the Highlands, but also, like, It was in other parts of Papua New Guinea. So the idea that this was the way it was being transmitted, there was reason to not think that this was a source. But here's just a little outtake from Shirley Lindenbaum about how this human consumption happened. When a body was considered for human consumption, none of it was discarded except the bitter gallbladder. In the deceased old sugarcane garden, maternal kin dismembered the corpse with bamboo knife and stone axe. They first removed hands and feet, then cut open the arms and legs to strip the muscle. Upon the chest and belly, they avoided rupturing the gallbladder, whose bitter content would ruin the meat. After severing the head, they fractured the skull to remove the brain. Meat, viscera, and brain were all eaten. Marrow was sucked from the cracked bones, and sometimes the pulverized bones themselves were cooked and eaten with green vegetables. In the North Fore, but not in the South, the corpse was buried for several days, then exhumed and eaten when the flesh had ripened and the maggots could be cooked as a separate delicacy. And I know, if someone told me that this was happening, I'd be like, I think it's from eating people. But I think it's also really important here to take a moment to talk about the religious symbolism of the consumption of the dead, and that it was actually deeply based in the religious belief of these people. The idea was that by eating the dead, they could incorporate some of that individual's positive characteristics into their kin. As well, they would essentially free the spirit so that they could go to the land of the dead and be reborn as an ancestor. It is really important to note, though, as well, that apparently the individuals who participated in this thought that human flesh was absolutely delicious. And interviews with older four women, and this is once again from Carew, the Science and the Sorcery, it was very interesting to watch how happy, like, her face looked the way my face looks like when I talk about, like, chocolate ice cream, when she said this: human flesh tastes very sweet. The skin doesn't taste so good, but the meat underneath is very sweet. And I think noting this, and what really tipped us off that this was the way that Carew was being transmitted, with the tip, okay, like, it looks similar to scrapies. With the tip, okay, it can't be genetically, was this. Who participated in the mortuary practices? It was the female relatives and their children of both sexes under 11 years old. And of course, the last thing we had to check before we could, like, really knock this off as the way it was transmitted was that fork would consume Karoo victims. Karoo victims were actually favorably viewed for the practice.
In the fork custom, if someone died of dysentery, which is diarrhea, leprosy, or yaws, they weren't consumed because there was some fear that it would transmit to the other people. But the Karoo victims were viewed favorably for the practice because it was believed that it wasn't a disease, right? And you have to remember that the Karoo people integrally believed that this infection was caused by a spell. And therefore, right, that person was cursed, and it's even more important to perform these mortuary practices to ensure that their body and their soul and their being as an individual is able to pass into the afterlife. So I think that that's extremely interesting.
So yeah, we've knocked it in, right? Like, boom, boom, boom. We have three pieces of the puzzle. But like, at this point in time, you really need a solid transmission study. And in 1965, we got it. Brain tissue from three Karoo patients had been inoculated 2 years earlier into chimpanzees, rhesus monkeys, marmosets, gibbons, pseudomagpie monkeys, all the primates. And they did it. It was transmitted. The monkeys developed Karoo. Interestingly, they tried it in a whole bunch of other animals, right? Like sheep, goats, mink, pigs, mongooses, opossums, dogs, ferrets, ducks, geese, and turkeys. All couldn't get it. They even tried mushrooms because, you know, people get really desperate. But finally, 1965, in a monograph called Slow Latent Intemperate Virus Infections, cough, this isn't a virus, but we'll get to that later, which resulted from a meeting convened in 1964, Gibbs and Gajetisic wrote in an addendum, although several of the inoculated primates died of acute infection during the period of observation, none had developed signs suggestive of chronic neurological disease until the recent onset in two chimpanzees. The first of these, inoculated 20 months previously with a suspension of frozen brain material from a Karoo patient, had developed progressive incapacitating cerebral signs and ataxia and tremors. The second, similarly inoculated with a suspension of brain material from another Karoo patient, has developed 20 months after inoculation slight wasting, lassitude, and some tremor, which appeared to be progressive. Whether these syndromes are spontaneous or related to the inoculation remains to be determined. And this transmission via injecting infected brains into primates provided more insight into the cannibalism hypothesis, but the combination of laboratory as well as real-world observation as well as that similarly to scrapies was what really allowed for this to be confirmed.
The final nail in the coffin for the cannibalism hypothesis came in 1961, when Michael Alpers was reviewing the surveillance that had occurred between 1957 to 1963, and he noticed a change in the distribution of cases. And what you could actually see, and this is so cool, and I'll put an image of it on the Instagram so you guys can look at it because it's super cool, but you can actually see a shift in the population distribution of Karoo cases. And that's being driven by the fact that upon the arrival of the Australian authorities, largely due to the very high presence of Christianity trying to be inducted into the four people, the endocannibalism stopped. And it's believed that kind of the last time it happened was sometime in the early 70s, but it had basically stopped amongst these people, and therefore transmission had ended. And I think that that's very cool. So that kind of put the nail in the coffin. We knew that the brains were the source of the infection. Consuming brains was the source of the infection from these different laboratory tests that we did. We looked at the cultures of the people and we put together, it's from their mortuary practices of consuming the dead. And finally, we saw that when we stopped that form of transmission, we could start to see a decrease in case numbers. And in like the magic of epidemiology, that is a beautiful kind of cascade of everything we need to understand how a disease is spread. If you stop the source, you stop the infections. And if you stop the infections, that's the overall goal. So I just always really appreciated the story about Karoo because I think it just really represents the best of epidemiology kind of in a single beautiful piece.
The conclusion was pretty clear. Nail it on the head. Cannibalism was likely the source of the infection spreading in these populations. But as I said earlier, even once we figured out it was in the brains, there wasn't a virus in the brains. There wasn't a fungus, a bacteria, a parasite. There was nothing detectable that we had ever seen before that could be causing the disease. And this is why Karoo is so cool, because it was the discovery of a whole new infectious agent known as a proteinaceous infectious particle, or to like other people who are in biology, because this is incredibly rare and not a lot of people know what they are, a prion, which is completely novel. So you may ask me, what is a prion? Why is it different from a virus and a bacteria? Like, what makes it so special? So a prion, in short, is a misfolded protein that's able to recruit other proteins and make them also misfold. So this process is important as proteins are one of the primary building blocks of our bodies and are very important to the structure as well as the function of many of our cells, i.e. protein no worky, body breaky. So protein misfolding can have really tragic consequences, as similar to wool, proteins are initially processed by our body into stronger strings that must be expertly folded to meet their final forms. And I think a really, really good way to make an analogy for this is wool, right? So processing has to happen to wool, right? Someone has to take all of the animal's fibers, boil them, and then they make this nice long string of wool. But a long string of wool by itself is nothing. You need someone, or in this case, it would be a chaperone. So there's chaperone proteins who do this. But right, you need someone with needles, and they expertly are going to knit this wool together to give it a final form. And in this case, in our analogy, they make a sweater, and now we can use a sweater, right? The sweater has a structure, it has a function, it works for us. But when someone doesn't know how to knit, it ends up just being a giant knot, and no one can wear it. Like, it has no function anymore. And that's kind of how the proteins work, right? So we have this nice long string of protein, and then it has to be folded and knitted together in a way to make it work. And when that misfolding happens, you have nothing. You just have junk. What's so weird and so intriguing about prions is that, like, I have, if in my closet, it's filled with sweaters, and these sweaters, beautiful, the best sweaters. And then if I take one of these prion sweaters that's completely misfolded and put it in my closet and close the door and walk away, and I come back and I open the door, it will have somehow made all of the sweaters in my closet transform into knotted, dysfunctional balls of wool that I can't use. So one prion protein, or whatever the amount that's necessary to actually transmit the disease, which I don't know, I couldn't find that number really anywhere. You just need one and it destroys all of your sweaters. So something to know, let's get back to the biology. So prions are the protein that is able to mysteriously convert other similar proteins into their misfolded form, right? But the actual protein that undergoes this initial misfolding is known as PRP, which is actually a pretty ubiquitous protein found in the central nervous system, including the brain and the spinal cord. And PRP, so the non-misfolded, so the properly functioning PRP in our body, is actually thought to play a crucial role in the growth of brain cells, also known as neurons. And it's thought to help develop connections between these cells, potentially control neuronal cell death, and to also control kind of how immune cells and blood cells interact with the neurons. But you may be surprised here, but today we know of multiple PRP variants that cause disease, creating a class of illness known as transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. These include some well-known illnesses such as mad cow disease and chronic wasting disease in deer, in addition to other less-known diseases such as fetal familial insomnia and Gerschmann-Strassler-Shanker's syndrome. And this entire class of illness results from the misfolding of the PRP protein, but just in different ways, and then somehow that PRP protein gaining the capacity to cause other, like, healthy PRP proteins to also misfold. Something to note, though, is that all of these aren't caused by the consumption of flesh, right? Some of them are actually spontaneous mutations in different individuals' cell lines, but also some of them are also transmitted through the consumption of meat. So let's get to the neuropathology of Karoo. So before I even start on the neuropathology, I want to apologize. I'm not a neurologist, a neuropathologist, a neurobiologist, a neuroscientist in any way. I'm just a girl with an undergrad in science who knows some stuff, who has worked on the human body in multiple capacities and gets what a neuron is and can kind of explain the central nervous system. So to anyone who is extremely experienced in this, I apologize if this explanation is not sufficient for you, and I highly suggest reading one of the brilliant papers that actually summarize this. For others who are more similar to me than the gods of the central nervous system that bless us and allow us to know more about it, let's just do a quick tour of the central nervous system. So the central nervous system, or CNS, is made of the brain and spinal cord and functions as kind of the primary control center for the majority of functions of the body and mind. So it controls our thoughts, our movements, emotions, and desires. It also controls both autonomic and somatic functions. So this would include like our heart rate, the release of hormones, regulation of body temperature, as well as things such as my ability to dance right now, even though you can't see me. So the brain, which is the main organ affected by prions, is made of millions of cells known as neurons that function as an interconnected circuit board that, when connected to our body through nerves, is able to transform complex electrical signals into large bodily functions. In addition to neurons, though, which are often seen as the star of the brain, there are additional cell types that support neurons as they grow and divide, known as neurogenesis, and create new connections between neurons as this happens, known as synaptogenesis. This other cell type, which is multiple cell types themselves, are commonly referred to as glial cells, which outnumber neurons about 10 to 1, so neurons ain't really that special. And these glial cells play an essential role in guiding the proper development and maintenance of the brain. As similar to complex machinery, the brain needs continuous maintenance to continue to function. And your brain is literally one of the most complex combinations of connections that are able to just so quickly change. It makes sense that it needs, like, a lot of maintenance, a 10 to 1 maintenance. Cell types that are included in the glial cells are oligodendrocytes that support the creation of myelin sheaths. So think about a cell that continuously changes the rubber on the outside of a wire, because that's basically what a myelin sheath is. It helps to kind of maintain the signal in the neuron so it can go longer distances. Another type is astrocytes, which maintain the blood-brain barrier, which functions as like a protective border around the brain. So they're kind of like the border guards of the brain. The next is microglia, which act as the immune system of the brain. So they make sure that infections don't come. And finally, the ependymal cells help build barriers between compartments, facilitating the segregation of your brain into functional compartments, some which we will speak about later. So what's really cool about Kuru and prion diseases is that they're able to largely affect many of these cell types, and that results in overall dysfunction and mutated appearance of the brain. So neurons that are found in the cerebellum, the compartment of your brain that controls balance and some aspects of learning, look moth-eaten. And small vacuoles, like, think fluid-filled holes, appear across the tissue in areas where it would have normally been super tightly packed and dense. So normally when you look at the brain, if you like cut it in half and you open it up, because you know we all do that regularly, it's like actually very dense in there, right? Like there's lots of neurons with very strong connections. So the idea that the brain looks moth-eaten should be very disturbing to all of us. As well, when we look deeper at that tissue through the use of a microscope, the tissue also reveals that the myelin sheath of the neurons show very high levels of degradation, suggesting that there's kind of a reduced capacity for the neurons to transmit signals between different brain centers, as well astrogliosis and microgliosis, so rapid proliferation of astrocytes and microglia happens. And it's believed that this results in neuronal cell death in some way. But also, super interestingly, one of the very, very unique pathologies associated with Kuru is that there's numerous amyloid plaques, commonly referred to as Kuru plaques. And what these really are, you know how before we were talking about like the PRP protein and then the mutated prion makes the PRP become prions? So these prions will aggregate with one another and they actually create this little clump that's unique depending on the different type of prion that is present. So these aggregations of misfolded PRP protein are found in high concentrations within the cerebellum, basal ganglia, thalamus, and cerebral cortex in that order of frequency. And these plaques appear to be star-like in shape, emanating from a dense center and always enveloped in an astrocytic process. But one of the most interesting pathologies of Kuru is that there's numerous amyloid plaques, commonly referred to Kuru plaques, that are found in the brain. And these are kind of those aggregates of misfolded PRP protein that hum together and are concentrated in different compartments of the brain. And these compartments include the cerebellum, basal ganglia, thalamus, and cerebral cortex in that order of frequency. These plaques appear to be like star-like in shape, and they emanate from a very dense center and are also often enveloped in astrocytic processes. Interestingly, the appearance of similar plaques are also found amongst multiple other neurodegenerative disorders, including varied Kruschel-Jacobson's disease and Alzheimer's, suggesting that there might be strong parallels in the pathology and causal mechanism of these different disease types. Finally, using immunohistochemical studies, scientists have also described the appearance of misfolded PRP at sites other than the Kuru plaques, including the synaptic and perineuronal sites, and in the spinal cord. And in the spinal cord, the substantia gelatinosa was particularly affected. So these are important findings, even though they sound like complete gibberish, as the congregation of misfolded PRP at synapses, where neurons share signals between one another, and perineuronal sites, which have been shown to be important regulators of neural plasticity, may in part explain why individuals with the illness quickly lose control of their bodies and emotions, as important neuronal connections are broken and are unable to rebuild. As well, something that's really cool is that the substantia gelatinosa is, quote, a gray matter structure of the dorsal spinal cord primarily involved in the transmission and modulation of pain, temperature, and touch. which may explain the shivering effect that's seen amongst curry patients, as disruption of this area could potentially result in exaggerated detections of temperature change, resulting in one of the primary characteristics of the illness. Super cool. So, obviously, much more specific details of this are present in the literature, and this is a very light skim of it based on what I could understand with my better than layman knowledge of the central nervous system, but definitely not expert. So if someone does want to read further about this, I highly suggest a review completed by Sebastian Bradner et al. Titled Central and Peripheral Pathology of Kuru, Pathological Analysis of a Recent Case and Comparison with Other Forms of Human Prion Disease, published in 2008. Unfortunately, a lot of our understanding of how these microscopic changes result in the disease haven't been entirely understood, and it's suspected that it is the sum of all of these changes that results in the disease state. This is exacerbated by the fact that all the samples examined have been taken from individuals at the end stage of their disease course, which adds to an additional complexity of knowing which of these histopathological characteristics first arise. This leaves an extensive field of questions that are still being examined and will likely lead to interesting and enlightening understandings of how the human brain functions and the role of the properly folded PRP protein in the human body. Now that we understand how Kuru works, how it was spread, and where it arose, we can finally touch on the final component of this podcast. How scared do we have to be? And in the case of Kuru, prevention efforts unknowingly occurred much before the agent was identified. Early upon the arrival of missionaries and the Australian government in the 1930s and 1940s, endocannibalistic rituals among the people of Papua New Guinea were frowned upon and eventually outright banned. The loss of this mode of transmission is greatly merited with the eventual eradication of Kuru, with the very last fatality recorded almost 16 years ago, in 2005. Therefore, I can confidently tell you that the chance of you becoming infected with Kuru specifically is almost zero, as the disease is believed to be completely eradicated. Woo! One for the bucks. But don't worry, there are many, many other transmissible spongiform encephalopathies to worry about, including hypotheses that there may be latent transmission of mad cow disease in some of the population of England, but that's for another week. On that note, I would like to say thank you so much for listening. If you loved this, hated this, have an opinion, please leave a rating and comment to help other people know, or even better, share this episode with a friend you think will love it. As well, if you haven't gotten enough of this podcast yet, you can find us at InfectiousCast on Instagram and Twitter. Also, if you have an idea for an infectious disease you'd like for me to cover next, send the suggestion to infectiouspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks, y'all, and remember to take care of yourself and those around you. The world is a big, scary place, but at least we can have one another. Peace!